This is Paul Rodell, IVS Oral History Project. Today is August the 29th, which is a Thursday, I think. Yes, it is, okay. And I'm in the home of Carol and Lynn Compton in Madison. And both the Comptons were as volunteers in IVS in Laos. Carol's time, like Lynn's, her husband, it was 65 through 67, although the months will vary a little bit. We'll get into that. While she was there, general job description was, in real terms, health work, sanitation, and some literacy programs, generally under the rubric of home economics and classified as RD or CD, however you want to do that. Because of IVS's own list, the actual list of people who served in Laos, listed alphabetically, had her husband. You can't see without your glasses?
No.
Well, anyway, has. I can't see without my glasses either. Oh, there. You know, it goes Terry Collins, J. Lynn Compton, and then Arnold Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, again. Once again, those things have fallen. The spouse has been ignored. although those are my distance glasses, so those will work. I've got some up close ones. So anyway, so only one form came to the Compton House, and it was addressed to Lynn, so he filled it out. And Carol only heard about things matter-of-factly, or, yeah, I don't know.
I just read it.
You just read,
read
what he wrote and said, gee, why can't I play with the boys?
Something like that.
Something like that. But even before going to the similar kinds of questions that Lynn was able to address in his summary on the survey sheet. Whether someone fills one of those in or not, we always start with some background questions. Actually, what I do is I make it one big question and then I shut up so that you can go on by yourself and I'm just kind of chirping. We're interested in the kinds of people who joined IVS. Now, this won't be giving too much away. Both of you guys were in Peace Corps before IVS. But what would make you be interested in that kind of service and overseas work? So we'll start out with when and where you were born, who your parents were, not just by names, but their identity through their community and their work, and what were the influences operating on young Carol as she grew up and to the point of joining anything to go overseas. And now I get to shut up and I turn this towards you and you go to town.
Well, I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota in November of 1940. And at some time after that, my father joined the Navy. And when he returned from the Navy, while he was in the Navy, my mom was working on her doctorate at the University of Minnesota. And in the humanities, when Dad returned, he went to law school. And later, Mom also went to law school. So both of my parents ended up being lawyers. My dad's father was a Methodist minister, and our family was a Methodist family. My great-grandfather was also a Methodist minister, and all of my grandfather's brothers were Methodist ministers. So it
was Methodism in your family madness, huh?
Right, there you go. And so,
sorry about that. I'm gonna stop that.
No problem. So there was a very strong connection to the church. I grew up very active in Methodist Youth Fellowship and in the church.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was active in UNICEF, and my parents were very supportive of the United Nations at a time when some people in our community weren't necessarily so supportive. My parents were very active in the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota. Dad became a state representative and later a state senator, and later mm-hmm. ran for Congress, actually ran for Congress while I was in
no kidding.
Peace Corps.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
He did not. He was the candidate who didn't win. Okay. But he did make it through the primaries, but he didn't.
He was Democratic Party?
Yeah, Democrat.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So that's DFL.
You said
Democratic Farmer Labor.
That's what the
DFL
Democratic Party is known as.
Is in Minnesota.
I just learned that recently when I was in the
mm-hmm.
Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, DFL.
Okay.
So basically, my family from way back was one that was involved in teaching and service. Grandpa had also taught. My mother
mm-hmm.
later taught at a community college. And was interested in the world, was committed to service to the community. Dad was on the school board. Mom was active in a variety of things like junior grade books, etc. And it was just, I went to a Methodist college. And when Peace Corps came about, because it was Peace Corps that I joined first, we were all very excited about it. And I applied and was accepted. And after Peace Corps, I got married to another volunteer, and he was already joining IVS. So I joined IVS because he joined IVS.
Okay.
But the kind of volunteer work was something I'd already done on my own before I ever met him.
Yeah.
So it was all within the scope of the things I believed in.
You over dinner, I must admit to the tape that we've already had dinner.
Yes.
You were saying that when you joined Peace Corps that there was something about the country selection process,
yes.
which I found kind of fascinating.
Oh, yes. I had, though as I look back on it, of course, I see that it wouldn't have been appropriate, but I signed up for community development and I listed three countries, Colombia, Peru, and the Philippines. My interest in the Philippines was because my dad had been there during World War II, and so I'd always been fascinated by that area, but I was at the time I signed up, my first choices were Colombia and Peru.
Okay.
Because I met a volunteer from Colombia, an American Peace Corps volunteer who had served in Colombia,
uh-huh.
and was very interested in the work. It was community development. And then...
So you heard the stories about that.
Right. And then I had always been interested in Peru. And so if I wasn't going to go to Colombia, I wanted to go to Peru.
And you threw in this Philippine thing.
I know, I added the Philippine thing because if I wasn't going to go to Latin America, then the Philippines was another place that I was interested
in. Because of your dad's stories.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, prior to that time, the only place I'd been outside the country was Canada.
Yeah, right.
So,
well, that was more international travel than I had when I...
Yeah.
But actually, right. then, you could say that at least as far as desire to join the discussions with the return volunteers, although not IVS, this is Peace Corps.
Right. Well, yeah. No, I had already decided.
You'd
that
already
I,
decided.
I had filled out the very first form that came out when I was a senior in 1961, and the forms came when I was in college, and I got one of them. I filled it out, but I didn't send it in because I thought they would want some wonderful A-plus fantastic student, and I was afraid I wouldn't qualify.
Uh-huh.
And then after I'd been working for a year and a half, I decided, well, I'll try anyway, and I filled out another form and was accepted. So I actually would have joined in 1961 if I'd thought that, but I was afraid that I, you know, just with a liberal arts background and an English degree, that maybe they wouldn't want me.
Yeah, well, who knows? But Okay, so you were.
But I was very much motivated at that time. There had been some young people in our state church who were made presentations about peace and international understanding, and I wrote an essay about world peace and so forth. And so when the Peace Corps came about, which was after that, it fit right in with things that I already had been thinking about in high school. And I thought it was a wonderful way for to have an exchange for people between two countries to get to know each other, and then maybe I could do something useful. I didn't really know how useful I would be because I was very young, but I thought at least we would get to know each other and help each other.
Yeah, okay. So what years was this Peace Corps stuff?
Well, as I say, the application, the first one I filled out was in 61, but I didn't actually send it in until 62. And I started in 63, in February of 63.
Okay, February of 63.
In training, I went into training, and then we actually got in country in June of 63.
Okay.
Because in those days, you did your training and then went right to country.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Went home for a week and then went right to country and went
oh,
to
really?
Thailand.
You got to go home?
I got home for a week.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, okay. Because we trained in the U.S.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, yeah, I did too, but it was Hawaii, so it's kind of hard. So then you got out of Peace Corps
in March of 65.
Okay, March of 65.
And I got married in June of 65 and joined
Ooh.
Yeah. At
wow.
home. And joined IBS in August of 65.
Okay. Now, but when you were in Peace Corps though, you were in Thailand.
Yes, I was.
So you knew about IVS, did you know about IVS when you were in Thailand?
I don't think that I did. I was
okay.
in central Thailand, and so I was not close to Laos. I may have. I did spend a time in northeast Thailand on doing some teacher training, some training of primary school teachers in English in Sakhon Nakhon province. And during the time in the Northeast, which was during regular school break, I went up to Vientiane one time and may have met some IVS volunteers at that time, but it's vague in my mind.
Okay. I was only asking about that because of the proximity and, you know, of
yeah,
the countries.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I just don't remember.
No, I'm just explaining my question because a lot of volunteers actually from both countries, but particularly Laos, would mention just going across the river and going, taking the train down to Bangkok.
Yeah, I didn't go to Bangkok much. I was in Lopburi. I didn't go down that much.
Okay.
So I didn't meet many people.
All right. So then you met Lynn while you were both volunteers.
We were both in the same province.
A lot of time to make the sparks fly and all that sort of
Only
stuff.
Only about a year, actually, because he... we had an overlap. I mean, he was in group two and I was in group five. So
that's really...
We didn't date at all.
Yeah, but I wasn't reacting to that. I was reacting to group two, group five. I mean, I was group 23, you know?
Yeah, we were early,
you're early on. Early
on
pioneers, you know? I just... No, I mean, in Peace Corps lingo, small size of the number of the group is the smaller the number, the bigger the status. You know?
right.
We were the real ones. We were the pioneers. We were the first.
Right.
Okay, so I don't know how much, probably not too much into the decision that you made, because you get married in June of 65, and only 2 months later, you're back into another volunteer activity.
Right. Well, I had actually been given or been awarded an East-West Center grant to study for my master's degree at the University of Hawaii.
This was after you were married?
No, this is before I was
This is
married.
before you were
This
married.
was, I think, in May or June. May, maybe. Oh, even before that, I found out.
But while you were still a Peace Corps volunteer. So you were going to go back.
I was going to
go
get
to
my
University
master's.
Go to University of Hawaii.
And get my master's in
You got this
Asian
nice cushy
Studies.
Thing from East-West Center.
And, but when I returned to the United States, Lynn asked me to marry him, and I decided that was a good thing to do, but I was still going to go for my master's, and he was going to join IBS. And so we went through, he went, actually I went with him through the language training. I just wasn't allowed to speak because I wasn't, you know, I was just a wife, so I wasn't allowed to speak. I mean, I could speak when it was group things, but I couldn't speak individually in the language class.
Well, you weren't accepted as a volunteer
right.
then because you were intending
right. so
to
they
go
let,
on. Yeah.
Right, so they just let me
Let you
attend.
Sit in, but you're not going to be a volunteer.
Right,
you're going off to be an academic.
Right, exactly.
So you don't have to speak the
right.
language.
But I studied it anyway. Mm-hmm. But after he'd been gone for 2 weeks, I said, who wants a master's?
You got the husband
right.
and you want to be with him.
Right.
Yeah.
So I called IBS and they all knew me down there anyway. And they said, well.
How'd they know you?
Because I'd been in Washington with Lynn while he was training
oh,
for IBS.
Oh, that's where the language
instruction
was. As soon
as we got married,
was.
We went to Washington with IBS. He was going with IBS.
Okay.
So he'd already made that decision before he asked me to marry him.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Well, or actually about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew me, and they said fine, and I went down there, and they said, well, you don't need the language training, you've already had it. You can work in the office and do secretarial work while you break for the rest of the group who, you know, who are volunteers in your group. And I said, well, what about if I go to Thailand and practice my Lao in Northeast Thailand with some friends while I wait, because we had to get FBI approval or
yeah,
something,
security
some kind
clearances,
of, right. And since I've been traveling for 3 or 4 months, I had, you know, a long list of things, places I've been or something. So they said it was going to take a while. And they finally, mm-hmm. I went to see Arthur Gardner, and he said, all right, you can do that as long as you promise that if you're not cleared, you'll pay IBS back your ticket.
That's a fair deal.
It's a fair deal. So I sent Lynn a telegram, I'm coming. He didn't know this. I hadn't told him I had joined IBS. And so I sent him a telegram, said, I'm arriving in Bangkok. Meet me.
Come meet me. Yeah.
Yeah. And suddenly there I was. And the then acting chief of party said, you know, come on up. So I did, and I started, and I was a volunteer. And
so you didn't bother to hang out in Thailand with friends learning language, you just went
no,
right
I got
into
cleared
things.
Right I got cleared very quickly, and I just went on up.
Cleared, you mean the FBI stuff?
Well, I guess so, because they
oh,
said
okay.
I could come up.
Okay, yeah, well, so. Maybe they run things in country a little more casually than they did in the,
yeah,
in the office
I
in Washington.
Who,
they,
yeah.
they probably said, oh, let her come. It'll be okay.
And it was.
Yeah, and certainly it was, yeah.
So, then initially we were in Baksan, and I worked with refugees when I first got there. I worked with Hmong, Thai Dam, Thai Dang, and Khmu in a refugee camp. They were refugees from Sinh Khuong, from Long Jang, and there were some Catholic sisters, Oblight. There were two Canadian sisters and 5 or 6 Lao sisters
uh-huh.
who worked with, out there with the refugees. And so I joined out there working with the refugees. And Lynn would go back and forth to the village that he'd been assigned to in the Pakading area in Mung Pak Chau. And eventually we decided to move to the village rather than doing this commuting thing, because I was going to one end of the province and he was going to the other.
Yeah, he described his work with clusters.
And so we moved to the cluster center or to the Ta Sang seat. Or, and then I worked with the teenage girls primarily at first. And then we did a survey of what were the kinds of things that the villagers wanted. And one of the things they wanted was literacy classes. And then I became involved in training the volunteers who volunteered to be the teachers for the literacy classes. So eventually we had 8 literacy classes for adults. It was very difficult in one village. A group of young women came to us and said that they had been excluded by the literacy teacher from the class because the men didn't want to study with the teenage girls. And these were men in their 40s.
They didn't want to be shown up?
They didn't want them in the same class for whatever reason or whose reason. And so they wanted to have a class of their own. And so we tried to find a young woman in the village who had could at least pass basically a third grade Bosam reading test. And we could find no girl who could read it, the third grade.
Okay, all right.
Who could read at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't able to set up the class because we couldn't find any woman who could teach, and the men didn't want to teach the girls. So that was very disappointing. Whereas in the cluster center, both girls, women, and men studied together at the same time. In that particular village, it was idiosyncratic. The teacher was just unwilling to do this.
Hmm.
But in most of the others, it was a mix of girls and women. And then we also did health and sanitation, made soap pits. We made 17 soap pits.
Soap pits? What's a soap?
S-O-A-K. Soak.
Okay.
Soap pits. There, the houses had a kitchen area usually at the back, which was almost like a little separate section, but attached to the house.
Right.
And underneath there would be a lot of waste from cooking and from children and from animals. That was a wonderful place for flies and mosquitoes to breed and so forth. And so what we would do is we would get the teenage girls in our class who lived in a home who had such an area, and all the girls from the class would go, and we would dig out all the slime in the club. And then we would. And then we would.
I'm sorry, I asked. What this was.
We would fill it in with sand and gravel, and make drainage for the water, so that the water would drain off under it. And then we would also teach using, you know, sorting your garbage so you have food garbage that you can feed the pigs. And
they didn't do this.
Some did, some didn't.
Oh, really? Okay.
But the drainage areas were almost all the same, a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this would, and we also did things like make kind of bamboo mosquito net covered half tents, if you will, to put over your food trays and different kinds of things to help improve.
Little basic things.
Very basic things.
Yeah.
So,
because I know my own experience. Those are marketed in the Philippines. You just
go
to the store and buy them.
But
were those?
There were no stores where we lived. We were 30. There was no road to our village.
Oh, so there wasn't even a traveling market?
There wasn't even, no. Nothing like that. It's not like the Philippines. Not at all. Mm-mm. No. It was 30 kilometers to a place where you could buy something.
Oh, yeah. I was 40 kilometers.
Right, but there was no Sari Sari anywhere.
Ah,
there was no Sari Sari stores.
My goodness! Oh, that I have a hard time conceptualizing.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it was right on the edge of the Snake Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side there were Petet Lao. The village we lived in had been Petet Lao headquarters for that area at one time. I guess during the free elections, we were told.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't know this from any. Written anything, people just said that.
So how I'm running out of English words, basic English words. You came in and it had been Petet Lao?
Yes.
How recently had it been?
Well, I don't know. That's because I don't know the history of that area, and I've not been able to find anything written down about that particular area. But it's not terribly far. It's about 20, 30 kilometers from the Kading River, depending upon which way you go. And it had been a sort of a crossroads area where a lot of fighting had gone on at different points in history. But very little has been written about that area. It's Bori-Kan Province, which is now called Bori-Kamsa. So, people said things to us, but I have not been able to read much about it.
Well, how did the people greet you in that place if they had just fairly recently, at least some point in the fairly recent past, been under Pathet Lao, and then they see these white people coming in?
They at first thought that we were Catholic, and they initially called us Kuman Kunpa until we explained to them that we were not. Because one of the villages in the cluster, a village closer up towards the road, had actually had some Catholic missionaries work in there previously. So initially, they did think that we were Catholic missionaries. Just by the way they addressed us, and then eventually, we explained because we both spoke Thai. So after having some Lao, we only had 3 weeks of Lao, but we were able to make ourselves understood and eventually converted to Lao.
So it was a relatively quick conversion.
It took quite a while for certain individual tones or word patterns to go away, but we understood. We'd lived in an area where we were not in Bangkok, we were in Thailand, and where there were Lao speakers, and we had friends who were Lao speakers. So we'd already heard Lao before, and we were able to make the adjustment relatively quickly. So we came in there with a great deal more language than the average, well, much more
Much
language.
more language,
Right. And, I mean, we could also read and write. So that's why I was able to get involved in the literacy work because I could. So.
That's right from the very get-go. That's right. This literacy is Lao literacy.
This Lao literacy for Lao, right. And I myself didn't have much Lao literacy, but I knew enough and had, because I'd been teaching language before, that with the IVS assistant who worked with me, who was just wonderful, named Bun Lap, we were able to work well together. She had been at Dong Dok, and she had been in a teacher training program, and then decided she didn't want to do that and dropped out. And I interviewed her, and we hit it off right away. So we worked very well together as a team.
Were you already being trained as a language teacher through your
Where?
college work?
No, I was an English literature major. I took no education courses. I didn't want any of those. But I did have
Will you have to
EFL.
get this, or will this be Lynn?
Didn't you get it? He did.
He did, okay.
Okay. I did have EFL training in Peace Corps for 3 months. And then I had taught English as a foreign language for 2 years. And also had some special training because I did some teacher training too when I was in
Oh,
Thailand,
good.
and so I had some special training to do that.
Boy, IVS must have just leaped at you. I mean,
I don't know, worked out well.
no, very rarely do you get someone so prepared in advance to step into something.
It was very important to have that much language going into the situation. I mean, we had only 3 weeks of Lao, but 3 weeks gave me some hints of the changes I had to make.
Well, I was thinking not only of the language,
For the teacher
but the
training.
teacher training.
In actual fact, I had wanted, this is a point that I would like to make in this interview, I had wanted to be involved in teaching and not in rural development work. And I was told that if your husband is in rural development, you will be in rural development. And so no consideration was given to my skills. Being from Minneapolis, I was not exactly, ready for this, but it worked out fine, and I'm very glad in fact, thankful in the long run to IBS for the experience, because there's no way. I had originally wanted to do community development work, and Peace Corps said, you're not qualified, and IBS said, you will do rural development work. And in fact, I think I probably did a pretty good job because of my language skills.
Yeah. Well, I was laughing while you were laughing, too. And I'm not I'll tell you why I was laughing, because I was thinking of, I'm going to pause this. I was going to put that on the tape, I think, because I think this point is good for me to have on here for when I listen to this again.
Mm-hmm.
And that That's is true. That your two examples are from two different organizations, giving two diametrically opposite responses to the identical request, and in both cases, their completely divergent responses are based not one iota on your skills or on your desires, on your qualifications, but simply on who you are, and that who you are is simply and only gender.
Hmm.
And I find that just so ironically funny and just downright stupid. I mean, I'm actually reminded of Nancy Ridenour, too, because I was really happy to see her, because on her form she wrote, I was in home ec because I was a woman.
Exactly. That's the only reason I was there. I hated home ec. Rural development I wanted to do. I did not want to do home economics.
And you hated home economics.
I always. Always. And so what I did was I did the physical labor, the health and sanitation, the soap pits, anything that was physical labor I was happy to do, or the literacy, which made use of my knowledge about teaching and language, where I had real skill. Because I didn't know how to sew, and I certainly
didn't know how to sew.
Well, I mean, you know, I had
a few buttons, maybe,
yeah,
but that's about
right.
It. Yeah, yeah.
And
even I know that.
Yeah, and you know, I never liked to cook, and
you did a great job tonight.
Well, that's good. That's learned behavior.
Okay.
But
of course, Lynn was saying, "Gee, could you stick around for a few more weeks, Paul?"
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But
sorry, that's on the tape.
No, that's okay. But the home economics assignment, I absolutely was opposed to, and they said, "Well, that you know, hey, you have no choice. That's what you will do." So I did it.
Uh-huh.
Another thing, as long as we're on my favorite issue here, was that decisions were made about quote wives, even though we worked as hard as the men and were volunteers too. I remember one occasion in which a nameless staff person came, and I served a dinner, and I served dessert, and they discussed what I would do in my program and never asked me. And afterwards, I was furious because the decisions were made with no consideration or not a single question to me. And that certainly didn't continue in our life, but it was the idea of the person who came in that it was the husband who should be concerned with what I did, not me. And that was very much an attitude at that time. I also remember the letter we received, which said to bring gloves and high heels before we left.
A letter from IVS telling
yes,
you what to bring.
What to bring, and included
high heels.
Right, to go to meet the ambassador's wife. And so the men went to meet the ambassador, and the women met the ambassador's wife. And we were volunteers too. And it was totally based on gender. And it was just...
Would a single woman... Oh, yeah,
yes,
she
all
also...
Women, all women.
All women.
Married or unmarried.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Could only meet the ambassador's wife, but not the ambassador.
Right, and of course, at that time, we didn't know protocol or whatever to say, hey, we are volunteers equally to our husbands. Why aren't we going to the other meeting?
Yeah, or I'm a single person. It's not that I'm... somebody's baggage.
Right. It was just female go here, male go here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that was the olden days. Hopefully that has long gone. But the probably the best part about IBS, as far as I was concerned, was being in the village.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
Working as a team with village community people. And the other really nice thing about it was having, they were called IVS assistants, but really we worked as a team. And we were friends and we worked together. And that team.
IVS assistants.
An IVS assistant. No one's talked to you about IVS assistants?
Well, maybe not with that particular.
Well, these were young Lao men and women, and of course a man was assigned to a man and a woman
yeah.
was assigned to a woman, who I suppose for those volunteers who didn't speak language, they were actually interpreters.
Okay, everyone has said interpreter.
We had no interpreters. They were assistants to us because we
okay.
didn't need interpreters.
All right.
I mean, they were learning, too, the dialect of the new area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly from time to time, they would be cultural interpreters, I suppose, for us. But
mm-hmm.
they
yeah.
were IBS assistants. And in fact, they were not called interpreters in the material. They were called assistants. In any event, I suppose that's what they did with others. But Lynn and I actually did some training for IVS assistants before they were assigned to Americans to help them prepare them for working with Americans.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, everyone, even if they should be calling those folks assistants, has always called them interpreters.
Yeah, well, I see. They weren't for us.
Yeah, well, maybe...
maybe that's why. That we never...
You never used them for that, and whereas maybe the other volunteers who should have used these people for more than interpreters because their language skills weren't as high as yours, primarily used them for
right.
interpreters.
And
so
that's
therefore,
what they needed to do.
They,
right. And
they
thought about
them
in
that sense.
Way.
And that's what
right.
I've been getting on the tapes.
Yeah.
And that's the impression that I've been getting, and I hadn't heard before tonight, assistants.
I think if you look in the old reports that the word was assistants, but perhaps
okay.
I'm wrong.
Well, you may be right, because I haven't had a chance to read through all the old reports.
Yeah. And we certainly worked together. And of course, as I say, in our sense, there wasn't interpreting going on for the most part.
Right.
My IVS assistant helped me with my Lao to clear out more and more of the Thai and to improve my tones and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Yeah. But much more than that.
Oh, but that was just something that she did while we were working.
On much more important things, in
right.
a sense.
Right, yeah, because we did the workshops on health and sanitation for both the refugee women and for the village women. These were all single women that we worked with,
mm-hmm.
usually girls between the ages of 13 and 18, approximately.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we did all the trainings together. And we would choose the
you
thing.
And the assistant always
yes.
together. Okay. Right.
Yeah, yeah. We did them together. Actually, there was a volunteer, a very interesting volunteer that I visited for 2 weeks before when I first got to Laos. Her name
mm-hmm.
was Carol Falk, and she was a volunteer in Ta Kek. And I watched her and her IBS assistant do their trainings. And
uh-huh.
so by spending 2 weeks with Carol and watching her in her work, I got a sense of the kinds of things, approaches and kinds of things that, you know, I might try.
Yeah, I think that was fairly common for people to be sent out.
To spend some time with another
spend
volunteer.
Spend some time,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was very helpful.
Yeah, Peace Corps did that a little bit. We didn't spend a great deal of time, but a few days. And I didn't find it personally, for me,
mm-hmm.
that important.
Yeah, well, it was for me because I was going to be working in a field that I never work in, which is home economics, and I'm a teacher.
Well, me too, but the guy I was assigned to hang out with was just drinking with his buddies, so.
Oh, no, she worked very hard. She was a very hardworking person. And
Carol Falk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where she is. Let me pause here. Let's turn this back on again.
Mm-hmm.
I forget where you were. You were talking about your work with your assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And got off on, we got off on Carol
Falk. We got
we
off
talking,
on the training thing.
Yeah.
The 2 weeks that I spent before I went. Yeah, what we did is after the 2 weeks, then with Carol down in Taukeck, then somewhere in there I interviewed a couple of people to be an IVS assistant, and I selected Moon Lop. She,
mm-hmm.
she was wonderful.
And you still keep in contact with her?
I visited her one time in France. She's in France. They didn't come to the U.S. because of family connections. They went to France.
Uh-huh.
So, but the Lynn's IVS assistant, he keeps in contact with. We used to visit him a lot when we lived in the same state in North Carolina, and he came to visit us here one time up here in Wisconsin.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we visited him there.
All right. Why did she leave Laos?
Because of her family. Her last name is Sanani Kwong.
Okay.
It's a big family in Laos. So they left. And her dad was half French.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was necessary for them to leave.
So she was from a politically incorrect family at some point? and then the French background would bring her there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And although I could ask Lynn this too, I mean, his assistant also left for similar reasons?
I suppose for politics, but he was not at all connected at all. No, I'm sure was just his own beliefs, and I suppose hers. She wanted very much to come here, but it didn't work out. When they all were leaving, we were in the Philippines. People tried to reach us in the U.S., and they didn't know we were in the Philippines. And so we couldn't help anybody because we didn't know where they were, and they didn't know where we were.
This is 75.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
74, 75.
Yeah, yeah.
When did we leave? Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking of the political changeover.
Right,
IVS pulled out May of 75.
Yeah. No, I don't. Where were we? Maybe we were, by then we had moved to Carolina from the Philippines.
Yeah.
But I know that we had moved and they had sent a letter to where we'd been before. And
never
and,
got
Yeah,
sense.
And then we later found out all about this when we met up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And straightened it out later.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But to get back to Laos and in yes. earlier time and
right.
Working on, well, the sanitation you mentioned with those ugly
right.
pits.
Yes, yes. The literacy was particularly rewarding. It was very hard to get titles. There was no library of any kind in our area, and the temple was just being built, so that there wasn't like a temple library because there had not been a temple in the village, and they were just beginning to build one. So I went to, when we started the literacy classes, I realized that there was nothing for people to read other than the little handout things that went with the literacy class. So I went to Vientiane and I bought about 100 titles, which is all I could find. I bought everything I could find.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hard to find materials. And I brought them back and we took a room of what we were calling the cluster center, which was just sort of a long barracks-like thing where Lynn would bring in farmers for training, and then I had one room for literacy and for the library.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have one of the IVS assistants, because we had another one who came to stay with us to prepare so that when a new group came, it would be an assistant ready for the woman who was coming. And so that young lady would do story readings from the books. And then we started a lending policy for people in the villages in the cluster, so they could borrow books and then return them. And that worked really well, because other than that, there was nothing to read there. You know, if a family had nothing to read, there was nothing to read. So
it wasn't just that they
were lazy to go out and get something.
Well, you would have to walk 30 kilometers to get anything. You know, there was no road there at the time, and people weren't bringing things in. So basically, another thing that we did is we had an information program where we would take, I often took the pictures, not always, but quite frequently, took pictures of different projects, development projects, like in one village, and did them like in a sequence of, you know, pouring the cement well rings and, you know, digging the well and putting them in and so forth, and make them kind of like a story, because since it was 85 to 90% illiterate in our area, so make it pictures that you could see what was happening.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you might write a little bit in Lao what village it was, or the names of the people, or you might not. And then you put that up on a bulletin board in the villages, so the different villages would know things that were going on.
And their neighbors.
Yeah, in their neighbors as well as their own. Yeah.
Where would you have the bulletin board?
The bulletin board would be somewhere in the village. I can't think of where it would be in the villages, because every village was different.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, they weren't all laid out in the same way, in some kind of a central place.
Okay. Because I was trying to think
maybe
my own
near
experience.
Paw Bond's house or something like that. In the village leader's house, maybe.
Yeah.
Near it. But it would be a freestanding thing, so anybody could walk up and look at it.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and it had a little tiny roof over it.
I was going to say, it was going to be bad for the rain.
Yes. And sometimes if something fell down, you know, if we had an tax or the tax disappeared, people would very nicely take a little sticky rice and stick it to the back of the picture and stick the picture back up. We never had anything missing. And they were always very careful about the bulletin boards.
Isn't that nice? They enjoyed it.
Yeah, because, you know, it was themselves and their friends involved in the development activities.
Yeah.
So.
The closest thing I can think of is the poster news in China.
Yeah, well, anyway.
It's a communal sharing of information.
Yeah, in pictures.
Yeah. And this case in pictures because of literacy, whereas the Chinese use the banners on the wall.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a very good idea.
It worked pretty well.
I'm just thinking, geez, I should have done that.
I really don't know where the idea came from, if, you know, others were doing it or whatever. Uh-huh. Anyway, that's what we did, and I don't remember the origins of it.
Yeah. So that's the literacy.
Mm-hmm. And then we did, this is kind of humorous, but I remember in the early days when we were interviewing the village women about the kinds of things that they would like, we had a sort of pre-given list that had been given to us of the kinds of things that people in home economics did, because we were working with in cooperation with the home economics agent of the Royal Lao government, but she was not she did not live right where we live, so she would go and come with us, but she wasn't living in our little complex. We all lived together in one big house.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, we didn't have a separate house. There were 13 of us living together.
Oh no.
Yeah. It was a cozy arrangement. And
even though you're married.
Well, there were curtains. And there were two bedrooms, and I remember when one couple left, we got one of the bedrooms, but initially we just had curtains. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was something. Anyway.
You know, I didn't ask you at all about your housing Because I simply assumed that you set up an independent housing.
Not initially, no. Eventually we did get one built, but it was a rather a slow process. The people building it for us took some time, but we eventually got it. Wow. In the meantime, we lived in that.
This tells me, as an interviewer, always ask the questions, even if they might sound dumb.
Yeah, don't assume.
Yeah.
Don't
13
assume.
People in the house?
There were the two of us, and then there were two other married couples.
So
no,
that's
no.
Six people?
No, there were three other married couples.
So 8 people.
And then there were the two IVS assistants, and there was one the child of one of the married couples. Oh well, then there was another baby too. Well, there were more. There were children too. I can't tell you exactly how many. I'm thinking mostly of adults.
Wow. Yeah. Because that's 8, 9, 10 adults at least.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Because 4 married couples.
Yeah.
Two assistants,
and then the son of one of the couples, and I know at least one of the other couples had a baby. One time I counted, there were 13, so there were maybe more babies than I can remember, children, little children. Anyway.
And all of these folks were involved in one form or another in the cluster operations.
Right, but some of them were RLG people.
Meaning?
Royal Lao Government.
Uh-huh.
And wives and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Because none of the wives were employed by the government, the husbands were.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah.
So it was only yourself and Lynn who were IVSers in
that
house?
No, and the IVSs, two IVS assistants, the woman IVS assistant and the man IVS assistant.
Okay, so there's 4 IVS people.
Right.
2 volunteers, 2 assistants. The rest are Laotian government and or spouse.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And their kids.
And kids.
Right.
Just leave that dot, dot, dot.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's quite an arrangement. See, because I...
And then eventually, you know, then somebody came to build us a house, and they built a house that was much too elaborate, actually. It was kind of embarrassing. It was a 2-story house. Everybody else had...
2-story?
Yeah, it was really weird. I mean, well, let's put it this way. Normally, a Lao house is on stilts.
Right.
So, well, our house was on stilts, but they filled in the bottom, and they made the bottom into an office, and then 2 bedrooms for the IVS assistants, and then they put us upstairs. But it was a pretty elaborate house.
The assistants were on ground level?
Mm-hmm.
How'd they feel about that?
Well, I don't know because it was cement, it was poured cement, and it had a bathroom, so it wasn't ground.
All right.
It was cement.
But still.
So they would have been like that some houses in Vientiane were like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that out of the ordinary.
Right, in Vientiane.
For that village in particular.
For that village it was out of the ordinary, very out of the ordinary.
But not for the capital and not for these people. And
right.
For these people.
No, yeah, because one was from the capital, and one was from Luang Prabang. So,
okay.
Yeah.
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 They're from the big cities.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But it was...
How are you going to keep them down on the farm? I don't know.
Yeah. But the house was, I think, too elaborate for the village. I mean, it really wasn't that elaborate, but it was.
Uh-huh.
Because it was... It was like a Western house too much, and that embarrassed me.
Uh-huh.
And it had like plywood floors, between the for the upstairs area, and they sent us furniture and stuff, and it made me feel uncomfortable because it was, but there was no house available to rent. There wasn't any house in the village that you could have. I mean, we had lived in the house with all those other people, and the option was to continue to live in that house, which
yeah.
was... but eventually...
And every other structure was already filled with somebody.
Right.
To as much capacity.
Yeah, right, right, exactly. I mean, they were... So, but if I'd had my druthers, I would have made a very typical Lao-style house. And made the office separate instead of making it underneath or something.
A separate room in the house.
Yeah, something, I don't know.
Yeah.
It just, it didn't feel comfortable to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was just too elaborate. And if you see a picture of it, I can show you a picture of it. You might not think of it that way, but I did.
Yeah. Well, I somewhat empathize. I had a house built for me in this Negrito community.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, we just had 1 bedroom up, and then we had the 2 bedrooms down for the 2 assistants.
No, we had 4 in a row. One, here, I'm going to pause this. Sure.
Mm-hmm. But there was, there were no more volunteers.
But there were no more volunteers after you.
No, because the village was attacked.
When was that?
Oh, gosh, we used to know 3 months, 4 months after we left.
Oh, you had already left.
Yeah, we'd already left.
Okay, all right. So it's
yes,
not that you
thank
had...
thank you very much.
No, it's not that you had to leave because...
No, not at all.
Because
we left in the normal time. We served the normal time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought maybe that, you know, your... not departure from the country, but from your location might have been hastened because local people were telling you that the Tepatatla were coming closer or something.
No, no, they were already there. They were already there.
I mean, for an attack. How do you know that they were already there?
Because they told us.
They?
Well, the villagers would say, did you know that there was a Tetlao riding in your car today? No.
Riding in your car?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to make sure, because you were biting
it
your nail.
It wasn't a car, it was a Jeep, yes. Yeah. I mean... that's the thing. And the night when you slept in the dry season, you could hear the big artillery going, ba-boom, ba-ba-boom, ba-ba-boom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could hear it in the dry season. You didn't nothing in the rainy season. But so you knew that the people were there, and they knew that you knew that they were there.
Mm-hmm.
So when we did a survey of the village, actually, Lynn and Ann Compone did the survey. There were no young men at all between 15 and, now I can't tell you exactly the cutoff, 21, 25, but there, whatever their categories, there were no young men at all in that category in the village.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Over 15 and under 25. They were all gone to one side or the other. And some were with one group and some were with the other.
Mm-hmm.
Some were RLG and some were the Tetlao, so... it was really an area that was right on the edge.
Yeah. Well, it had been...
right, in the free elections, it had been Tetlao.
Yeah.
And there had been, a women's group in the village under the Tetlao and so forth. That's what the ladies told me.
So they were already well organized.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it wasn't in our... knowledge functioning while we were there. You know, there was a home guard in the village, and
mm-hmm.
there was a little place. One night there was shooting, and so we left our house, and it later turned out that a husband was shooting at his wife's boyfriend. But we didn't know that. When you hear guns at night, you just get out of there.
Yeah, especially if it's close by.
Right. It was one or two houses away. And another night we heard machine guns and all kinds of guns all around, and it was very scary. And even the home guard who came to escort us out of there thought it was a real attack. But it was the night the frog was eating the moon, and no one bothered to tell us about this custom. And so it's funny to tell about it now, but we were terribly frightened, and we hid out. I hid out in the library, my favorite spot with my books, with Bunlap, my assistant. But it was rather frightening.
Your assistant didn't know?
No, she didn't know either. Well, we just didn't know what day it was.
Okay, but...
she didn't know. She was Lao, yes.
Yeah, but, well, the actual festival is, or occasion is what?
Gopkin Dunan. The frog is eating the moon. The eclipse of the moon.
Okay.
And the custom, oh, I'm sorry, you don't know these things.
No, no, the frog eating the moon, I've heard of this before, and I thought it was an eclipse.
Yeah, of the moon, yeah.
And so I just find it strange that somebody who is Lao, your assistant, doesn't know that this is what's going on.
Well, it's kind of like nobody said anything about it, and maybe we were busy that day, and it isn't like a festival. It's when it happens, people shoot.
Whenever it happens,
people shoot
at it. And she just happened not to see that this was going on.
Right. She was sleeping or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Or nobody mentioned it to her.
Okay. All right, that clears it up. Because I was wondering, how could this be?
You know? Yeah, no, no.
Okay.
She was as scared as I was.
So you never felt, other than the occasion of the one guy shooting after the wife's boyfriend and the eclipse. I'm going to sneeze. You never actually felt threatened any time?
No, personally, no. I really love the people in my village, and I think in the villages around, and I think they knew that. Glenn did too, and we worked very hard, and we just assumed that they knew that we cared about them, and they seemed to care about us, and I mean, you know, so it was pretty naive, but we didn't think that anything would happen. That's why we were so shocked the two times of the shooting, but still we didn't think that anything would happen.
The two times of the shooting you mentioned?
Those two occasions that I just mentioned, yeah.
Okay.
Because we were sound asleep and these things happened.
All right.
All of a sudden the guns are going off all around your house.
Well, I thought you meant not those particular incidents that we were just talking about, but I thought you were making reference to some other incidents that happened.
No.
Killing of IVS.
No, no. Though I must say that at one point I had wanted my brother, who was a teenager at the time, to come and visit us, which would not have been a wise thing, but I wanted him to come, and it was about that time that Fred was killed, and so that took care of that idea. But when things began to happen when Marty's plane went down, Marty Klisch, when his plane went down, it was very worrisome because you didn't know why the plane went down, and they couldn't find him for a long, long time. And then there were other shootings. Towards the end in 67, it was getting worrisome. There's no question about that. But still, somehow, you didn't feel that anything would happen where you were because these were your friends. These are the people that you cared about and you were working for. So, night.